Okay, we are back. Always a welcome edition. His name is Congressman Lee Zeldin, of course, representing the 1st Congressional District. We say a very good morning, sir. How are you?
Very good morning to you. It's good to be back with you.
It is great to have you as the show continues on Capitol Hill these days. You know, it's interesting to me with Nancy Pelosi taking to the microphone yesterday, Congressman, and basically stating to the American public that articles of impeachment would be drafted here. But then, you know, what really caught me was the kind of one-on-one she had with a reporter, where the reporter had asked her about what seemed to be, to him at least, some hatred towards the president of the United States, which Pelosi stopped dead in her tracks, came back to the microphone. There is no hate here. You know, I always refer to body language, instincts, how a person reacts as far as the deeper mindset is there, as far as what one really thinks there. That, to me, really kind of got to me as far as the Speaker of the House yesterday. Give me both assessments from you, articles of impeachment, and maybe that little barrage that everybody had witnessed.
As far as articles of impeachment go, the reality of where we are today, if you look at 100% of the evidence as opposed to 3% of it connecting dots not connected, relying on hearsay, guesses, presumptions, if you look at the entire story, they do not have a case for impeachment. And they don't have a case. You cannot impeach the President of the United States for what they are thinking about drafting up here. What they are relying on is for you to ignore 97% of the story. They want you to ignore the fact that Ukraine didn't know that there was a hold on aid until the end of August, that it was released shortly thereafter, and that Ukraine didn't have to do anything in order to get the hold released. They want you to ignore it. They want you to ignore the fact that there actually were Ukrainians. There's no comparison to Russia. I mean, Russia, you have a larger government led effort with regards to meddling in the 2016 election, but you have Ukrainians who did in fact get involved in the 2016 election, and that's Ambassador Charlie, the Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S. You have Alexandra Chalupa, the DNC consultant working with the Ukrainian embassy in Washington, D.C. to dig up dirt. You have Ukrainians with the Black Ledger to help bring down a member of the Trump campaign. Avakov's comments, that list goes on. It's indisputable that Ukrainians interfered in the 2016 election, and I thought it was in our national security interest to be concerned about that issue. That's not about the about serving anyone's future individual campaign. That's an issue that's actually been the subject of a DOJ investigation. They want you to ignore any legitimacy to the fact that Burisma was this corrupt Ukrainian company run by a corrupt Ukrainian oligarch that was paying Hunter Biden $50,000 a month without any Ukraine experience, without energy experience, and then that fact pattern goes on. But that was an actual investigation into Burisma and Zelensky. That was not just a legitimate issue. It was an actual investigation that started before Donald Trump was even in the presidency. So anyway, I'm just giving you a few samples of what that story about the other 97% of the facts start to look like. What we're having is a moment in time of total gridlock. The country is being ripped in half. It's being done to appease an enraged base that helped put Dems in power in the House in 2018. It's a payoff to them. A lot of the people pushing impeachment were pushing for impeachment before any of these facts even evolved. It started when the president got elected and when he was sworn into office. With regards to the one exchange, listen, I have an issue with what I see with some of my colleagues and many, many of their supporters is that people are filled with hate towards this president. You don't have to like the president of the United States. I opposed there were certain policy proposals of Barack Obama that I was publicly outspoken against, especially as it relates to Iran, for example, and some of the other stuff in that region. But I didn't hate him, and I never was trying to impeach him, and I certainly wasn't trying to stop everything else in order to do it. And if someone was suggesting he should be impeached for something, you know, I would push back. I'd say, listen, you're not going to get 67 votes in the United States Senate to remove him from office, even if you go down that road. So what you're doing is essentially stopping everything else from happening to move our country forward. There might be some people who are pushing this who don't have as much hate in their hearts as others, but that is an issue, a conversation for a country to have, because I'll tell you what, hate in the heart is something that is motivating a whole lot of people who are pushing it. And that's something that I think people need to, as you go into this holiday season, especially if you're a prayerful person, and you're coming into a new year and you're making New Year's resolutions, is the fact that the 2016 election happened and it's over. The 2018 election happened and it's over. And if you have a score that you want to settle like this, settle at the ballot box. There's an election that's less than a year away where you get to choose who the next president of the United States is.
Here's the other problem I have, and I think a lot of people do, Congressman Zola, is the fact that Nancy Pelosi, if she were truly out to protect the republic from the threat she claims this president poses, well, to me at least, she would take the time to do it the right way. Instead, barely checking boxes here en route to what, you know, is a foregone conclusion, it seems. Fast enough for these candidates to get back to Iowa in 55 days, whatever the heck it is. But, you know, the rush to judgment and everything else, you kind of get a sense, and I said it all along, the failed Mueller investigation and probe and everything else, the window of opportunity that existed here with Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler, you could kind of get a sense, deposing people behind closed doors. I mean, it's just one thing after another. If people decipher exactly what has gone on in the last 5.5 weeks, they too can get a sense here, kind of a rush to judgment, and it's so obvious what's going on here.
Yeah, and you could look at whether it's the closed door depositions and the way they were run, the public hearings that took place over a couple weeks and how they were run, or Judiciary Committee hearings that just started and how they're being conducted. There are so many issues. I mean, I could go on and on each of those three phases of it. And I'll give you just one brief example of right now where we're at the Judiciary Committee, where just before the start of the Judiciary Committee hearing, you have the Schiff report get released, and it's not enough time for everybody on the dais or they're one of the witnesses to be able to digest the report, and still the underlying evidence hasn't been provided to the Judiciary Committee, still to this day. You're bringing in people who are like supposed to be academic to analyze constitutional law candidly and, you know, without, you know, predetermined judgment and outcome, and just analyze what the law says. And especially for two of the witnesses, I mean, you have four people to vote for Donald Trump. Putting that aside, I mean, two of them were way off of the ledge, and they were presenting their answers as if they were fact witnesses, as if they had all the facts in front of them. And this was so out of order. If you're going to bring these people in and you're going to have a conversation with them about the facts, let's at least present the facts to the committee first. And the Schiff report, if you want to look at what happened during the Clinton impeachment, where Ken Starr brought the Ken Starr report in person to the Judiciary Committee under oath, answering questions from Republicans, Democrats, and President Clinton's attorney for cross-examination. Here, instead of Adam Schiff bringing his report to the House Judiciary Committee on Monday morning, he's sending one of his staffers to go do his dirty work for him so that he doesn't have to answer any questions about his own report. This isn't the Daniel Goldman report. This is the Adam Schiff report. And that should have happened first before you're going to bring in some academics to tell us about what their legal analysis is of the facts that aren't even yet before the committee. So that's just one example. And again, as I mentioned, you could go through each of the phases of what's taking place to your point of how rushed it is and on the process and on the substance, how screwed up it's been.
Just nothing getting done. Nothing getting done, Congressman, as far as other things, funding of government. You know, you can go on and on and on here. Trade agreements in place. There's so many important things to be accomplished, and the dysfunction of it all has everybody awry here. But because of time constraints, we could talk another hour about this. A couple of things before we have to let you go. The Pentagon, I guess, considering sending thousands more troops to the Middle East. I guess there is a new threat to U.S. forces posed by Iran, something you have to be keen on and everything else. The right thing to do, no less, here.
Well, the one thing that to keep in mind, and this is something that consistently is going to be part of the discussion at the Pentagon, across administrations, different countries in the Middle East and other regions of the world. And it's, you know, whether it's at the White House and you're meeting with your National Security Council, or it's the president meeting with his cabinet, or it's that agency itself, like the Department of Defense, trying to develop options and planning for different contingencies, from the conventional to the unconventional, from large scale to small to, you know, not at all with you know, a different country at a particular time, is that the Department of Defense is doing its job when they are planning for all different kinds of possibilities. Because if something happens, you know, God forbid, let's say Iran did something today that we weren't expecting them to do today that causes a massive escalation, and let's say they're targeting, you know, God forbid, U.S. service members or U.S. national interests, or they targeted the United States, you know, domestically itself, any of those, you know, horrible scenarios that would significantly and instantly escalate this, you don't want to start having that conversation as a reaction after Iran does that and say, okay, well, let's start developing our options so that we can figure out how to respond. So you're going to always see the Department of Defense having these conversations and the planning. That doesn't mean the decision has been made. And unfortunately, the way some people take reporting of, you know, Pentagon talking about sending thousands of more troops somewhere, that doesn't mean that with that particular story at that time, that it definitely means that we're actually going to be sending thousands of troops somewhere. I think we just need to understand that on any given day, the Pentagon all across the entire map is planning for different contingencies so that we're ready. So that we don't have to just start the brainstorming of what our options are after something bad happens. We have a plan in place for all the different possibilities, and it would be foolish for us not to be having that conversation, especially with regards to the biggest threats. And, you know, whether it's, you know, what you might be talking about Iran, or you're talking about cybersecurity as it relates to China, North Korea, Russia, and Iran, you could talk about different forms of warfare. And you should be leaning into all the possibilities and what you might want to do with it if the other side strikes.
Now, before I let you go, I love when people get awards for the right reason, whether they're here or they're not here. And posthumously, an award given to William Maldonado, who was indeed such a cog in the fight against MS-13 in these parts. 31 years, part of the Soviet police force. And an award given to him in posthumous-type fashion, but well-deserved by the Attorney General, William Barr. I know you were present there, and I know you kind of feel the same way.
The service that we see of our law enforcement all across Suffolk and Nassau right now, as all of your listeners are going about our lives and feeling more secure in certain battles than we have in the past, understanding that there are still plenty of challenges that still face us, there's more to do, but knowing that we get to live on Long Island where there are amazing men and women in blue at different levels of government who work well together to keep us safe. One of those people who have been doing amazing things over the course of decades, over 30 years, was William Maldonado, and he passed away not too long ago, but posthumously, it's still an important message to send to also remember the life and legacy of service, and also to bring his family in from Washington, D.C., to bring colleagues in to Washington, D.C., and for others who are just joining the force today. You know, when one person takes off that uniform the last time, or they're using their badge and their training for that last time, and it's a handoff to that next person who's coming in to serve for the next 31 years, or someone joining the force right now in 2019, 2020, who will be serving for the next 30 years to keep us safe from any threat, whether it's gang violence or it's the heroin and opioid abuse epidemic, it's large white-collar crimes, or it's something small that greatly impacts the quality of life. For that career that's just getting started, it's important for them to understand, to feel that inspiration from those who came before them. So, I mean, I view it as not just a celebration of one life of service, but it's a celebration of their family for serving as well. And it's also a message to send not just to our community, but also to future law enforcement, you know, of the big shoes to fill, of what they are eagerly trying to fill, and the importance of it. So I'm thrilled that the U.S. Attorney General took the time out of his day to pay tribute to one man's service, understanding that that Long Island is filled with people all across the island, serving at different levels of law enforcement to keep us safe, and we really should be honoring all of them.
Well said. If we do not talk, I want you to have a great holiday season. A lot happening. We know. We'll keep an eye on things, but we certainly appreciate a couple of minutes here.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.